Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. The magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door four times a year, each issue filled to the brim with the articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including, from time to time, your intrepid KingCast host. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, then you'll need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you gotta do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And guess what, boils and ghouls, if you use the code KingCast at checkout, you will save a whopping astronomical, massive 25% off of your subscription. Once again, that's code KingCast at checkout. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam!
Anybody's gonna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name's Scott Wampler.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And we are your hosts. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the release of Mary Lambert's Pet Sematary, an all-timer King adaptation starring Dale Midkiff, Fred Gwynne, Denise Crosby, and of course, Miko Hughes as the doomed Gage Creed. We wanted to do something to mark the occasion, so we're here today with the directors of the 2017 documentary Unearthed and Untold, The Path to Pet Sematary, which we recommend all of our listeners to check out. If you're even remotely a Pet Sematary fan, you want in on this. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the KingCast stage, Misters John Campapiano and Justin White.
Hey, guys.
John, did I say your name right?
Yeah, you did. Nailed it.
Okay, excellent. Nailed it in one. Off to a great start.
No, thanks for having us. It's been a while since, you know, Justin and I were in production on that project, so it's fun to revisit it with you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, where do we even start here? I guess I want to ask this. I am a huge fan of documentaries, just in general. One of my favorite genres. And I am endlessly fascinated with how they get made. When I look at like a documentary or say like an oral history of something that's, you know, like Kyle Buchanan wrote that oral history of the making of Fury Road. Mm-hmm. I look at these things and I'm just like, where the hell do you even start? Like to organize all this stuff, to edit it into, you know, so there's a through line, so it's satisfying, combing through all the archival footage and you know, everything else, interviews. It seems like an insurmountable task to me. So but I guess my first question is, how do you do this?
The idea for this one started with a poster, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, John showed me his Pet Sematary poster that he got signed by the cast at one of the conventions he went to, and immediately found out that I was a fan of the film as well. And I don't know, what was it, like a couple of months later, you suggested that trip to Maine to go see where it was shot?
Yeah, I mean, so this, you know, this documentary is different, at least for me, in terms of my other projects where the, you know, you're consciously starting out saying, okay, I want to make a documentary, but this one was really kind of organic and started just, I think, as a trip to go see the locations, from the movie. Both Justin and I are big movie location nerds, and growing up in New England and, you know, you go to Martha's Vineyard to see where Jaws was filmed and stuff like that. Just like love stepping into movies. So the original idea was to go to Maine and just see the locations. And once we started going up there, you know, we started meeting people, and it was like, oh, if you're interested in Pet Sematary, you should speak with this person. And, oh, this person has photos from the set, or, hey, you should, you know. And so, like, suddenly it was like, now we're making multiple trips. And I think at one point we thought, oh, maybe this would be a book, you know, like an oral history book. And then it was, oh, maybe it's a short, you know, a video for YouTube. And, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Justin, but it was like, we had like a number of interviews in the can and a ton of archive that no one had ever seen before we were like, oh, maybe this is actually becoming a documentary.
Well, I didn't know how much I could really contribute to a book or something of that nature. So I figured with my background in, you know, video, you know, doing a documentary on video only made sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it's, you know, that's sort of a long-winded way of addressing your question, which maybe isn't even an answer to your question. But I mean, at least with this project, we didn't realize we sort of had a documentary until we had like a half-finished documentary in our lap. And it was like, oh.
All right.
We also have to keep in mind from where we lived, the shooting locations in Maine were about 6 hours away. So we really wanted to make the most out of it every time we went up. So in order to really find these kind of hidden places, we had to reach out to a lot of different people up there through the Historical Society and just word of mouth, trying to get, you know, pinpoint these locations. And that's kind of how we started networking with people. And that's how, you know, people would kind of let us know, hey, this person has photos, you may want to talk to them, like John was saying, or that person was on the set, you know, during the, so, you know, it became more of a, let's talk to these people and, you know, see what it was like when they were shooting.
It's a nice side effect, I think, of them shooting on location. You know, you wouldn't have had that same experience if Pet Sematary was all shot on a back lot, you know.
Absolutely not.
And, you know, you mentioned, you know, visiting Martha's Vineyard for Jaws, and there are certain parts of these areas of the country, especially in New England, that feel like they don't change very much over the years. Mm-hmm. And like you go to Martha's Vineyard, you're walking around Amity. There's everything still looks and feels the same. And I was struck feeling that way kind of going through Bangor when we were out there for our KingCast thing, Scott, and like we were. Mm-hmm. Like we were, you know, we did the SK tour stuff and we were like, okay, yeah, this is cool. And then you go to the cemetery, you know, from Penn Cemetery, you're like, oh, this is, this looks exactly the same. I could see Stephen King standing there, you know, in robes, you know.
Yes. Did you guys take the SK tours thing while you were in Bangor?
No, we didn't take the tour. We interviewed the guy who does Stu Tinker. Is his name right, John?
Yeah, I think his son now sort of manages that. Yeah. I have taken it. The tour since, but not during the years that we were putting this project together.
The Pet Cemetery, like the visit to the actual cemetery on that tour is like kind of mind blowing. Like that cemetery itself is gigantic. Like I think it's, I don't know, like the first or second biggest graveyard in the country or something like that. Mm-hmm. I forget the exact stat, but huge and just very expansive, and to stand right there where like King filmed his sequence was really awesome, like a highlight of that tour.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. We knew we had to incorporate that cemetery in a big way. We shot a few of the interviews there, tried to match them up to, you know, the exact scene from the film. Mm-hmm.
So. Right. Now, how difficult was it to compile the interviews? That's a big question, you know, that is always kind of at the top of my mind when I see something like this all expansive thing. You know, I had a little bit of experience doing this recently where I wrote this big oral history for The Mist, it turned out very well, and you know, so well that it probably should have been a book instead of been on the website that laid me off fucking 8 months after. I found that like the secret to doing that was getting one good person that was like involved with the production that is like totally 100% into what you're doing, and they will always like be the first. Like Denise Huth, who was one of the producers on The Mist, was that one for me where she's like, oh, you should really talk to this person. You should really talk here. I'm going to email this person who doesn't do interviews, but they'll do it for this, cause I'm going to tell them to do it. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah, was that out. Something that you ran into or was everybody just like, you know, fuck yeah, let's talk about Pet Cemetery.
Well, it was split, right, Justin? I mean, like the locals, I don't remember any pushback from locals. I think that they, you know, probably hadn't ever been asked to speak about their experience, certainly not on camera. So I think that the Maine people were really enthusiastic from what I remember. I mean, you know, we were shooting interviews in like 2011, 2012. So it's
feels like a long time.
But, you know, the Maine people were very receptive from what I recall. And obviously we've got stories about, you know, getting more of the talent. I think, right. That project was unique because it was our first foray into anything film related. So we had no CV of past work to point back to say like, no, look, we're legit. We finish things, we make things, you know? So, there were a handful of casts that were good to go. Miko, Brad, a couple other people. And with some of them, once you sort of got them on board and they had a good experience, they would then advocate for us. And then they would, that person would then advocate for another person.
Well, that was like Brad. He and Denise were friends at the time, and I'm sure they still are. And I think he didn't he say that their kids played baseball or something, and he used to see her all the time at the games. And
yeah, their kids did Little League together.
Yeah. So we interviewed him and got to know him, and he, you know, talked to her, told her we were legit, and same thing. We interviewed her. It went great. And she went to Mary Lambert and advocated for us. So it was really positive word of mouth that really kept the ball rolling in terms of who we were able to get for interviews.
I think the best story about this in terms of like casting the doc was the twins, Bo and Blaze, because they were very kind to us, but they were sort of like not interested. And I tried and tried and tried for months and months and months, and they were just not really interested. And just, you know, they were sort of out of the business, and they weren't, they just kind of, they weren't feeling it and didn't want to really participate. And, but then towards the end of production, you know, I reached out again and they were like, well, they're like, who have you interviewed then? Just tell us. And by then we had interviewed everybody. Yeah. And so I think then the feeling was like, oh shit, well, we can't be the only people not in this. So suddenly it was like, no, thank you to, oh, we better do this because now we kind of stand out as the people,
yeah,
that, you know, said no. So that kind of worked in our favor.
Yeah. That's like crucial. Like I remember when I got Darabont for the Mist piece, when I got him, there were two, I think it was two interviews. Andre Brower was one that like his agent like specifically said, if you get Darabont, then he'll do it, but he's not going to do it if you don't get Darabont. And sometimes, you know, people just need to know that they're going to be investing their time, you know, wisely with you on this kind of stuff. I'm sure that there's, for every, you know, one of us who've made either an oral history or in your case, a full on real fucking documentary, you know, for every one of those, I'm sure that there's been a few people that are like, I really want to do this. And then they get bored and like, don't end up ever doing anything with,
well, there could be a real risk in it too. If you, you know, get on board with people who aren't, you know, the real deal, and
that's
who,
true.
Who knows what you're going to do? Who knows what they're going to do with your interview? You could, you know, they could twist it and, you know, put it into some context that the person didn't, you know, sign up for. And so it's a risk.
Well, and I think too, I mean, you guys have interviewed a lot of people too. It's sometimes you need to get really creative with how you approach people. You know, I mean, I think, it's good to walk through the front door and go through an agent or go through something, but sometimes you're just not going to, you're not going to break through. And so it's better to find like a side door, or a side window. Yeah. You know, I've got a funny story about that that's related to the Pet Sematary doc, or I'm sorry, the Pennywise doc that we can get into later if you want to hear a funny story about casting somebody. But anyway,
yeah, of course,
you got to get creative, you know.
Yeah, we've run into that a couple of times doing the show. I think the weirdest like attempt at booking someone on this show was we tried to get Alan Moore on. You know who Alan Moore is? The comic book guy that wrote Watchmen and a number of other things. Like a legend. And we figured this guy would have something to say about Stephen King. And so we tried to go through, I forget how we found this out, but like it turns out that Alan Moore does not have email. And so you have to email a guy who hangs out at the pub that Alan Moore hangs out at, and he relays emails to Alan Moore. And
that's a good idea.
Baffling. Like, what? Like, how are you getting anything done? But I mean, then again, you're Alan Moore, you know, you've found your success. and then we got like the nicest letter back from him about, you know, passing or through his pub friend, I should say, that was, you know, very gracious, but he didn't really want to do it. And yeah, that was weird as shit. Tell me your weird story about Pennywise.
Well, it's not so much weird as it is just sort of like an example of how the industry can be, especially how,
sure,
you know, agents view independent documentary filmmakers. We were trying to get Seth Green, and I had tried for months and months through his agent, and she kept telling me, you know, thank you, but he's not interested. He doesn't want to do projects that look backwards. He's only looking forwards on new work and new projects. And, you know, I got that rejection multiple times. So I sort of put it on ice for a while, and we were in LA filming interviews. And one of the interviews was with the casting director from the miniseries, Victoria Burroughs, who is beloved, and she's worked on everything.
Yeah.
As we're wrapping up with her, she said, well, have you spoken with Seth yet? And I told her what I just told you guys, that the agent said he's not interested. And she said, oh, that doesn't sound like Seth. So like by the time I got back to the hotel, I had an email from her with Seth saying, hey, I just got finished with these guys. They're great. They're doing this documentary. And Seth's like, oh, this is the first time I'm hearing about it. I'd love to do it.
Yep.
You know, yep. He hadn't even been told about it. And so sometimes, like I said, it's, you got to find that side door or the back door. To get to people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of gatekeepers in this industry, and probably for good reason, you know. Okay. But we run into that on a weekly basis trying to book the show, and I'm coming up short, Scott, in my memory. Maybe you can, you know, help me out here, but I remember that there's been two or three people we've gotten on the show where we just got a flat, like, you know, are you fucking serious? You know, of course not. Of course, are my clients not doing the show from their publicist or whatnot?
Right. And then when we got in touch with them directly, they agreed to it. Like,
and they were so excited about it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I don't understand. Like, I guess I understand it to some degree, how publicists work and how the whole game of it all works. But like, at a certain point, it feels like you're kind of doing your client a disservice by not relaying the request at all, seemingly.
Yeah. I've said this before. I think that this project has really kind of been like the gold standard in terms of luck for documentaries. I mean, I think if we were to try that something like this again, you know, start from scratch, I don't think we'd have even half the luck that we had. I mean, fortunately, we picked up a spot where, like we said before, the people were very willing and very, you know, cooperative and, you know, eager to share their stories. But, you know, I think if we went and started from scratch somewhere else, it would have been a much, much different story.
There's also something to the timing of it, too, where it seems like this whole, I mean, there's always been documentaries, especially in the era of, you know, of DVD superiority, you know, when people were releasing 15th anniversary of Fight Club or whatever the fuck was, you know, was coming out. And then we're getting all these look back documentaries, but it feels like, especially in the last like 10 years, because there've been a few successful documentaries, there've been a few successful like oral history, you know, kind of articles that now everybody's trying to get in on this and trying to copy it and do something different with it. So I think you guys also, you know, you struck at a very nice time kind of between the death of the DVD documentary and commentaries and all that stuff. And before the internet figured out that people actually will read oral histories for more than 3 minutes, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it's true. It was sort of the early days. I mean, you had Crystal Lake Memories and Never Sleep Again, I think, was already sort of out in the world. And right. I know that, my buddy in the UK, Gary Smart, his company had done, I think, their Fright Night documentary right around that time. But there wasn't an oversaturation of, you know, BTS content for all of these, you know, films, cult films and stuff like that. So
right.
Certainly not the way that you see it now, you know.
For sure. These days, if you wanted to do it, you're going to have to make them eat hot wings that get progressively hotter. That's the only way that they'll do it. So
exactly. The one thing that's kind of lost in any conversation about documentaries based on horror movies is that they are sort of filling the role that special features used to play, like on disc. And we just don't get that anymore. We don't get commentaries. You don't get any of the cool shit that, you know, as Vespi pointed out a moment ago during the heyday of DVD. And right. there's value in them. You know, if you're a fan of whatever the topic is or the subject, you want to see this stuff. It's cool to see, you know, archival footage and interviews and hear about these people's experience making the movie. So you're doing King fans a service, I think.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, like, you know, fans are just thirsty for more. Like yeah. So often, especially if it's a film that you love, you can watch it over and over again, but it's just not enough. You're looking for that extra stuff. I mean, I remember having the Jaws Laserdisc and the Jaws 2 VHS box as a kid and watching Laurent Bouzereau's documentary about Jaws, which I still think is up there as sort of, it's on the Mount Rushmore of like docs about popular films, and just watching that over and over and over again. And so maybe in the subconscious, there's something there with like my interest in getting out and doing this. And I remember, Justin, you and I used to talk about this all the time on those, like, you know, we had serious windshield time going back and forth to Maine about how, you know, Paramount is never going to do this. Paramount is never going to give Pet the sort of love and attention that we feel it deserves, knowing that there were a lot of stories out there about the film. And I think that also you get into some sketchy territory that I've since sort of learned more about, of like how close you are if you're making a documentary and you're a fan of the source material. How can you be objective? Can that hurt or help your product? Which is sort of a sidebar. But we just knew that Paramount was never going to do what we were setting out to do. And so yeah. It falls to the fans, you know, or the people that are passionate to go ahead and do it and fill that void.
Yeah, it's important. It's important. It really is. Like, it, I'm a physical media guy, as anybody who's been in my house can attest. I'm surrounded by walls of Blu-rays and
same
4Ks, and you know, I still have a whole wall of straight DVDs that I haven't upgraded from. Probably in a couple of thousand at the very least at this point, right? And there's some. I love physical media, but like, I do kind of really miss the days when this was just the norm. And I can't help but look at some of the apathy that I've seen from younger generations towards cinema and movies and fandom in general. I see a lot of hyperfixation, which was always there. There were always the Star Wars and Star Trek kids and whatever that was their thing. But now I see people who, they find one thing and that's the only thing they're interested in, with Stranger Things or it's an anime or it's, you know, Pokemon or it's something, and that they have zero use for anything else. And I have to imagine that there is probably a really smart looking graph out there somewhere that shows the decline of DVD special features and commentaries and in-depth documentaries, any of the Peter Jackson, Lord of the Rings, you know, extended docs and, you know, that kind of stuff. A decline of that, and then also the decline, you know, that mirrors the decline of you know, kind of the new generation's interest in that stuff. Because you're right, when you like something and you can have a $20 disc that has 4 hours of how this thing was made, like in depth, step by step, it makes you curious about the process. It makes you curious about other movies. It makes you curious about the art form. You know what I mean? And that's something that I you know, really regret is not a thing anymore. You have these boutique labels that'll do commentaries and whatnot, but and you know, God bless them. I love Scream Factory, and I hope they keep coming back to Scott and I to come do commentaries, because we love doing that. But honestly, it shouldn't have been us doing a commentary on Silver Bullet or The Dead Zone. It should have been, you know, right, David Cronenberg. It should have been, you know, the people involved. You know, I'm glad that there are people out there, you know, that are still willing to do special features, but even those companies are like, talking to them, they're like, our budget to doing this is zero because there's just not, you know, people aren't buying this shit anymore. So right. I don't know. I somehow got on my physical media soapbox, and I apologize for that. But my point still stands. I think that the work that you guys are doing, particularly, you know, with the areas that I'm interested in specifically, like, you know, you're in my wheelhouse when you're doing It and Pet Sematary and whatnot. You know, it's you're doing a legitimate service by, you know, kind of getting these people and their experiences on record, you know, in ways, like you said, right, that the studios won't support.
And it's interesting too, seeing something like this through the eyes of the fans, instead of the studio putting it out with their own ideas and their own agendas and whatever. You know, we just kind of went at this as fans, so that's, you know, that's how we approached the whole project as, how, what would we like to see? How, what would we like to, you know, talk about? That's how we crafted all the questions and everything. Just
right.
Stuff that we hadn't heard about before.
Yeah. And there's an art to it too. Like you mentioned the Laurent Bouzereau Jaws documentary, like that is like 98% just people sitting down 20 years after the fact talking about something. It's not, you know, a super inventive in how you're getting all this crazy, unique behind the scenes footage. You get a little bit of it, but you know, it's mostly just people sitting around sharing their war stories about, you know, this very troubled production, and it becomes fascinating. And you realize at a certain point, you don't need all the bells and whistles if you have, you know, invested people with really cool stories. And that seems to be your bread and butter as well. Like specifically, you know, that you were able to capture in both of the Stephen King documentaries, capture the feeling of what it was like being there and, you know, but also not being afraid to talk about times when people were uncomfortable and things, you know what I mean? That's the kind of shit that's authentic. And I think what you're maybe talking about when you're saying you know, it's not like a studio produced thing where it's like, oh, we can't talk about this drama. We can't talk about, you know, this kid feeling left out of the losers club, you know, or whatever, you know, we can't do that part. But again, it's all history. Like, you know, I take this shit fairly seriously. I take movies seriously, and, you know, and I love having an accurate history on record. Right.
Well, with Pennywise, you know, we knew that we had to address the spider in a big way, right? Because and would Warner Brothers have been, would they have wanted to be as candid as we tried to get about that? Just as an example, you know, that comes to mind when I hear you talking about it. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've mentioned a few times that you were King fans. I suppose we should get your Stephen King origin story. Like, when did you first become aware of King's work?
You want to take this one first, Justin?
Yeah, sure. I don't actually remember. I mean, it's, you know, the kind of thing, like, how do you know when you started enjoying pizza? It's just the kind of thing that's kind of like always been there. I know when I was a kid, my mother has always, you know, encouraged me to be, you know, a big reader. So she bought me a lot of the novels. She knew I was a horror fan, even as, you know, a little kid. And I think she felt that getting me a, you know, book like Needful Things and all that stuff would be a little less tame than, or a little more tame than watching, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street and that kind of thing. Right. So
sure.
She got me a couple of the Stephen King novels, and, you know, I don't know how old I was, but I remember them being heavy, so I must have been pretty young. I didn't end up reading them at the time, but, you know, I remember, you know, when Stand By Me came out, it was just like, oh, that's the same guy? So, I don't know, it was, I didn't really have that, you know, this is Stephen King, and, you know, you're... I don't know. I just don't really remember like how it first came about.
Fair enough. And John?
Well, for me, mine's a little different because I think I remember exactly sort of when I discovered him and sort of his craft. As an only child, a lot of my early horror movie exposure was through neighbors and friends, older brothers and stuff that would rent things and then show us, you know. And I remember seeing the two tape set of the miniseries It and seeing, you know, the little headshot of Tim as Pennywise on the spine of the tape and mm-hmm. them popping it in and not getting past the Georgie scene. And I lived we lived right across the street, and this was the summertime, and I distinctly remember, I wish I could go back and see this moment, because I'm sure I was not nearly as subtle as I thought I was. I was like, oh, I hear my parents calling me, I've got to go, and like bolted out of their house because I was terrified. And that was sort of my intro into, okay, what was this movie? And then talking to my mom about it and her telling me that, you know, Stephen King is like, he's the New England guy. He lives in Maine. He writes these books. And I just remember thinking like, whoa, this guy lives like in our region. And just thinking that was so cool and feeling like a connection really early on to him in that way. And it's something that has sort of carried with me, I guess, as we've done these documentaries. And so, yeah, that moment, I think, was the very first time that I really became aware of, like, King and his ability to really kind of scare us. You know, obviously he's so much more than just that, the scares. But at the time, like that experience is totally burned in my memory.
Right. Were you?
And when
were
you? Go ahead.
I think we're probably about to approach the same thing. Were you children when you saw Pet Sematary? Forgive me, I have no idea what your ages are. So were you kids when you first saw it? And is that, you know, something that grabbed you, you know, as well, like from that?
I was probably approaching 13. I remember seeing it very late one night by myself. And I was just like, yeah, what the hell am I doing? I'm not going to sleep tonight. So that was my first foray into the world of Pet Sematary.
Huh.
Yeah, I would have been 6 or 7. Again, there was a kid that lived behind us who was older, and he had rented it. And I remember being on the top bunk. A couple of my buddies were on the bottom bunk. I was up on the top bunk. And I remember just, you know, the gauge getting hit. And right. There was something in me at the time where I wasn't necessarily scared, but I was disturbed. Like that scene and the Zelda stuff was hitting. It was hitting in a visceral way that like wasn't scaring me, but it was like disturbing me. It was like car crash. Like I can't look away. I want to, but I can't. And yeah, I would have been, I mean, that home video days, I was born in 85. The film came out in 89. It was probably like 92 or 93 when I first saw Pet.
I feel like if you were under the age of 15, probably under the age of 30, if I'm going to be honest, and you saw Pet Sematary for the first time, Zelda like is still in your nightmares to this day. I think that there's something I can't even pinpoint exactly what it is that Mary does with the Zelda sequence that is so off-putting, you know, but it's there's something about both the real life version of Zelda, you know, that we see through the stories that are being told, and then the nightmare version that we see after. There's just something about the makeup and the actor and there's something about that gets so under my skin in a way that like even the most best constructed classic, you know, horror cinema masterpieces doesn't. And there's something about it. I don't know. It might have just been the age I saw it, but I'd love to find out exactly why that shit works so well.
Yeah, I mean, it hits everybody differently. I think. I know personal story. My mother, her best friend, had a sister who was disabled, and she kind of had to sit in this. It was like a swing type of thing, but she had to be fed and all that, very much like Zelda had to be. And I remember as a kid going over to their house, and I would just hear that swing kind of creaking back and forth and watching my mother going in and out of that room. And just as a kid, that was pretty terrifying. So when I saw a Pet, that's all I could think of was like, you know, I kind of understand this character for somebody who didn't have that kind of experience. I mean, yeah, it is terrifying experience.
Right.
Absolutely.
Welcome to the Midroll Ad Read, everybody. I have two sponsors to tell you about. First up, from Gretchen Filker Martin, the acclaimed author of Manhunt, comes Cuckoo, a vicious new audiobook about a group of teens who must stay true to themselves while in a conversion camp from hell. In the summer of 1995, 7 queer kids abandoned by their parents at a remote conversion camp come face to face with something evil buried deep in the desert. 16 years later, they are forced to confront it once more. The fate of the world depends on it. Listen to a full cast narrate the book Roxane Gay calls, quote, absolutely masterful. Cuckoo is available wherever audiobooks are sold. Next up, we have a brand new sponsor to tell you about, and that's the good folks over at Mint Mobile. After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch? Here's the thing, folks. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They don't have retail stores or salespeople. Instead, they deliver premium phone plans directly to you. I've always heard of Mint Mobile, but I never really looked into the details until they decided to sponsor the show, and I found out a couple of things that surprised me. One, you use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number, so that means no uncomfortable period where you're trying to figure out who's trying to text and call you. Are they a scammer? Are they your friends? You don't know. Don't have to put up with that if you switch to Mint Mobile. Secondly, all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/kingcast. That's mintmobile.com/kingcast. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/kingcast. Now, Mint Mobile wants me to read a little disclaimer here at the end, and I've always wanted to do one of these things like they do in the TV commercials. Let's see if I can give it a shot. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower, above 40 gigabits on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Nailed it. All right, back to the show. One thing that I'd like to talk to you guys about since you're here is, you know, the fact that, you know, one thing that I love about this is that you're not here promoting like, oh, here's the new thing. I love that there's a big push to get the Pet Sematary doc kind of back in front of people. And maybe you guys can talk a little bit about that. Like there's, you know, a marketing campaign and getting kind of people to put eyes on something that you've worked on in the past. Is there a story there, or was it just like one day you're just like, you know, fuck it, this is a good thing. I don't think enough people saw it. Let's put it back out there. Like what was the thought process there?
You want me to take this, Justin?
Yeah, sure.
Speak to that a little bit. Well, I think everybody loves a good anniversary.
Yeah.
Knowing that it was the 35th, I had been in touch with one of our colleagues over at Terror Films and had mentioned that we're putting together a book. Gary Smart with Dead Mouse Productions in the UK, he was producing partner with me on Pennywise, and they've done a lot of great docs. We also did the Robert Englund biopic doc that came out last year. Anyway, he has in the past, he has taken sort of raw interviews from the documentaries and worked with a writer and taken, you know, photos and archive stuff that didn't make the doc and put a book together, sort of like a companion piece to the doc. And so he had been asking me for years about doing one for Pet. And I was appeared at a convention with Miko up in Buffalo over this last summer. And Miko was telling me about all these photos that his mom had found from the set that nobody had ever seen before. And I was just thinking, oh, you know, it's the 35th is coming up. Maybe now is the right time to try to do this companion book.
All right.
And Terror Films has been really supportive of trying to, like, you know, sort of get the doc back out onto people's radars. We're doing a big cast reunion up in Bangor in October that I'll be appearing at with Dale and Denise and Miko. And that's the first time that they'll all be together in Maine since they filmed.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it's just, yeah, it's just been kind of like one of these things where just piecing the stuff together and trying to tap the anniversary angle and, you know, drum up some more interest in it. So it's been exciting. It's cool.
No, that's great. And again, I think it's a service, both, you know, getting it down in novel form, getting it in documentary form. You know, this might not be, you know, taught in schools kind of history, but it's the kind of history that deserves to be written down, and not to put too much weight on your shoulders there. So don't fuck it up is what I'm saying. Yeah. What's Miko like? I've heard he's super cool. I've never run into him, even though I think we've been at like the same cons, you know, doing different things, you know, at the same time before. But I hear nothing but good things about that dude. So unless you're about to break my reality there, so don't answer the question.
Not at all. He's super cool.
He's a deviant. Oh no.
No, Miko's great. He's super down to earth. He, you know, I've seen him at shows, conventions, I've appeared at shows with him, and he's just so gracious with people. I think there's a weird disconnect for him and the Bo and Blaze, the girls who played Ellie in the film spoke right to this as well, that there's like an odd disconnect of people wanting to meet you and get their photo with you and get an autograph from you for something that you did that you yourself have very spotty memories of.
Right.
Right.
It's a weird thing. But no, he embraces it. Miko's really great. Funny story. Justin will get a kick out of this. So Miko was, I think, our second interview.
He was. Yep.
And I mean, so for me, I was typically the guy asking the questions and, you know, communicating with the talent. And so that meant that that was my second time interviewing anybody in life ever. I mean, I didn't go to film school. I never really had ambitions of making docs or films as a kid. It just sort of happened naturally. And so I was still pretty green. Because you said earlier, you know, interviewing people, it really is sort of, it's a muscle that you build and you work on it. You know, it's so, I remember somebody had told us, someone in Maine had told us that Miko liked to dance on set as a kid. And I just, we were like, well, that's quirky. Maybe there's a story there. And I remember in his interview being like, so Miko, we hear that you like to dance. And he just kind of like paused and looked at me a little bit, kind of like quizzically. And he's like, I mean, I guess if I'm drunk enough. And I was like, all right, next story, next question.
So confirmed, Miko Hughes drunk on the set of Pet Sematary, age right. two.
Dancing, exactly.
That's why you got hit by that car. Yeah.
So, you know, but no, Miko's great. Nothing but good stuff to say about him. And he's really embraced this whole, you know, this whole thing. And he's, you know, he's a filmmaker himself now. I mean, I think he primarily is behind the camera, but he's on sets and making stuff. And, so he's a creative in his own right, which is great.
Yeah. It's gotta be. I mean, I've interviewed a bunch of child actors over the course of doing my job. Some of them when they're kids and some of them when they're up and grown. And there's always that interesting fucking thing, you know, we're talking to Henry Thomas and it's just like, is every question I'm going to ask you going to be about something you did when you were 9 and 10 years old? You know, it's like, right. Like then I try to remember back to what I was doing at 9 and 10 years old. And I'm just like, I don't have any fucking specific memories about that stuff. And these poor fucking people, they're always getting grilled about, you know, Miko's case, you know, something he filmed when he was still in diapers and or like Kindergarten Cop and or, you know, one of these like, you know, kind of iconic movies from his childhood.
And that's why we kind of had to gear the questions more so based on like the years since the film, you know, his take on it now. What is he, you know, what has he heard throughout the years? You know, what is the you know, what has the impact been like? That kind of stuff. Because we knew that there was, I mean, it was pointless to ask him anything about, you know, his experience on the set. I don't know. I think he was 3 at best.
Well, I think memory is so weird in that way too, because, you know, he's grown up hearing stories about things he did or about, you know, Fred Gwynne. And so then you become an adult and it's like, you know, are these my memories? Like, are these firsthand memories? Are these just things I've been told over the years? So like I said, it's a very kind of an odd thing to be, you know, lauded and fawned over for something you did that you don't really have a memory of, you know, it's unusual.
Picture memories is what he referred to it as. Yeah. There's a lot of picture memories.
You got virtually everyone lined up for this, Unearthed and Untold. But one notable absence is Stephen King. And I'm curious if you reached out to him and, you know, there was, you know, any sort of conversation that took place there.
Yeah. We definitely pursued many different avenues trying to get a hold of him.
I mean, to be honest with you guys, I mean, we got very close. We basically had gotten, again, back to that theme of like trying to find a side window or a side entrance to get to people. We had gotten an address. We had gotten an address for a summer home in Maine. And so I wrote him a letter, like old school, put a stamp on it, like sent it, sort of got the endorsement from the person that was connecting us, who Steve knows and has known a long time, another author in Maine, and pled the case, basically, you know, said that this is a doc about the perspective of the local Mainers and the impact that the production had on the area. And I think it was a couple of weeks later, Justin, that I got an email from someone in his office saying that he would grant us an interview.
Something like that. It was relatively quick.
And I mean, we were just on cloud 9, you know?
Right?
And without naming any names, basically they said, well, when this other person is back from vacation, she'll set it up for you. And it never happened. Basically, it was sort of shut down. And so but we got so close, so close.
So close.
Yeah, no, we had a similar, you know, we ended up getting King on the show, but we had a similar thing where it's like, oh God, we took a shot in the dark. It was like a friend of mine that like knew him, and I'm like, oh, maybe you'll pass along the letter. And he's like, yeah, Steve will do it. And I'm like, great. He's like, but it's going to be 8 months from now or something. And we're like, fuck, anything can happen in 8 months. He can absolutely change his mind, decide not to do it. And then when we got to that 8 month mark, then like the can got kicked a few months, and there were like multiple points between the yes and when we actually did the interview where we're like, well, fuck, we're fucked. He hates us. He doesn't want to do it now or whatever, you know, where you kind of get in your head. And I can absolutely have seen that have been the end result for us too, of like, no, the person's just, you know, the person that would set it up is just not interested in doing it or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
That could have been us at literally any point in the thing. I mean, listen, yes, it would have been big. It would have been, you know, great, but like it's you guys, you know, your doc wasn't about the history of Pet Sematary. Like Stephen King has to be part of the narrative, but he doesn't have to be there to talk about the movie. You know what I mean? It's like,
well, that's why we got a lot of people to kind of fill in those gaps.
Right.
We talked to a professor from I think it was Vermont, right, John? Tony, who's from Vermont?
Yeah, University of Vermont. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was good friends with King and knew all about his history. So that's kind of how we were able to, fill in that part of the story. Right. Same thing with the SK Tours guide, very good friends with him. And, you know, he was able to fill us in on a little bit more. So that's how we kind of got around
I mean, I agree with Justin, and I think it's nice to frame it that way to make me feel better about not getting him. But look, it sucked. I would have rather have gotten him in, you know, especially for that project, even more so than the Pennywise doc, because, you know, it was shot in Vancouver. You know, Pet, that was significant that they filmed it in Maine. And
yeah.
Obviously he had a cameo in it. He knew a lot of the people personally. You know, so I think having him riff on, you know, the Orrington Cemetery that he discovered and writing the book and that would have been pretty powerful. And I wish we could have done that, but I think as a plan B, I think we salvaged it well enough.
Right.
Definitely. You know. And I mean, Stephen King has talked about Pet Sematary a bazillion times. You know, I feel like the value in both of your docs is that you're seeing this footage and like photos and all this stuff that, you know, some of it I had never seen before.
Yeah.
And that history is super important. Your movie didn't need it, you know, basically. Yeah. I'm sure it would have been great, but you know, it definitely wasn't hurt by that.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the film starts with footage of King speaking at UMass Lowell.
Yeah.
And he actually did grant us permission to record that ourselves and use it for the film. So
for whatever
that's worth, he was on board at least for that.
Can you talk a little bit about Mary? Cause Mary's somebody also that we've, not to keep bringing it back to us, but like somebody that we'd love to get on the show. And we're like, we've talked to her a little bit and made the pitch, and she follows like social. She followed on social. There was all this weird stuff where it felt like, oh, this is all, we had all the makings of getting her on the show, but she didn't seem to be all that keen to talk about Sematary. At least that was the impression we got. But again, like, I think that's one of the most unique things about the movie is it's one of the few King films that's actually directed by a woman, you know, and specifically that story, which is, you know, centered on a man breaking down. Like today it's weird that it seems like, you know, if you're a black filmmaker, they want to make you make black movies only. You're like that. Okay. This is you only make black movies. If you're a female filmmaker, you know, unless you're Catherine Bigelow, like we want you to make female driven films. And I love the personality she brought to it, the point of view she brought to it, you know, the story that might not have been, like, you know, at the time deemed one that should be told from a female perspective. So I don't know why I'm rambling about this, but I do love what she brought to Pet Sematary. And even as much as I'm not a huge fan of the sequel, I love how fucking wildly different it is and the swing that she takes with it. Yeah, you know?
For sure.
So maybe can you talk a little bit about her?
She was another one that we got via word of mouth. Like I said before, Denise and her were very close. And so we, made an impact with Denise, and she knew we were the real deal, so she went to Mary. But and we met Mary when she was visiting her son in New York. So we had set up a little studio in a place we were renting, and she met us there. And I got to tell you that was one of the most intense. I don't think I was more nervous for any other interview.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like, you know, this is the big time. I mean, the way we were looking at it was, you know, this is kind of like our ticket to getting King. Once we get her on board, I think that's what we have to go to bat with. Like, we have everybody, including the director. Why can't we get Stephen King now?
Yeah. I mean, Mary, you know, just to echo Justin, I mean, Mary is great. Mary is like a brilliant artist. You know, I think, she's a painter. She's super, super visual. And she's like maybe 5 feet. I mean, she's right. But she commands such a presence. I mean, we were at that studio, and it was like fifth or sixth floor up, the studio just outside Times Square. And I went down to meet her. She was taking a cab to the studio, so I went down to meet her on the street. And she has just such an intensity about her. Like, that was like the longest elevator ride up to the studio where we were filming.
Right.
In the best way. I mean, not in a bad way. Just like, she's just like, she's just intense and has like a real presence.
Right.
And, but she was great and super gracious and funny. I don't know. I mean, to your point a minute ago about like maybe you sensing that she didn't want to get into Pet.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not, you know, what her feeling is, but I think that there might be some kind of like, you know, she's done different kinds of films. She's done family films. She's done dramas, siesta. She's done all kinds of stuff. She's, right, like I said, a painter. And so she's done a lot of work. And I think there must be some weirdness. I don't even want to say resentment, but there must be something there where sort of you're kind of remembered for one thing, or people only just want to ask you about maybe one project or two projects. So right. I don't know if there's something there, but
it could have just been the timing too, because I think that what I remember during lockdown, I was rewatching Pet Sematary. It was probably for something to do with the show. Maybe the first time we covered Pet Sematary on the show, I'm like, I'm going to rewatch this. And I had like the Lazy Boy out and like my feet kicked up, and my cat, who has never once in his life sat and watched a movie with me, like legitimately watched the screen. He jumped up, sat like in between my feet and like just stared at the screen for like 90% of the movie. And I took a couple of pictures of like him, like it's, you know, that the looking behind a cat, you know, through his ears essentially at the screen, and he's and he's watching like you when Church is hissing, you know, the famous shot with the reflecting eyes and whatnot, and then like pictures of like the Gage, you know, shoe on the ground or whatever, and he's like intently watching it. And I tweeted like a series of those pictures of like my cat watching Pet Sematary, and she, like, even though I didn't add her or anything, like she ended up retweeting it and stuff. And so I'm just like, oh, she definitely likes Pet Sematary and cares about this stuff. And then maybe not so much, but, or I mean, listen, I'm sure she's proud of it, but maybe not so much in terms of wanting to agree to come on and spend an hour with us jackals, you know, talking about her work.
Your description of her, sounds about right to me. She strikes me as a formidable presence. You know, I feel like she'd be kind of intimidating to interview, and especially for something this major, like one of the all-time best King adaptations, where, you know, you were relatively green when you did this, John. Like, were you intimidated during that interview?
100%. My sweaty my hands are sweating now, sort of reliving how I'm feeling. Like, the only other similar interview experience I've had since then is when we interviewed Tim Curry at his house in Burbank.
Oh, and man.
Yeah.
You're just walking on eggshells. You're just like, this is, you know, you feel like a combination of like just deep gratitude that they're even doing it. You have like this imposter syndrome of like, why are they talking to us? But also just like the intensity of just, you know, who they are. And yeah, I was super intimidated by Mary, you know, again, not because of anything sort of negative that she was bringing to the table, but I don't know. She just has, some people just sure. have that. They just have that.
Feeling. Some people have that steel in them, you know?
And I think part of the reason too, was that, you know, this was her baby. And we didn't, you know, we didn't really have, you know, all the questions that we wanted to ask. And if we asked, you know, the wrong question, I don't know. I just had this feeling that it could go sour really quick. And, you know, I knew there was a lot riding on it. So.
Well, it kind of did. I asked one wrong question. Do you remember that, Justin?
Oh, yeah.
What did you ask?
Yeah. I won't name the person I was asking her about, but I was asking her about somebody from the crew. And I said, tell me, you know, what was it like working with so-and-so? And she just said, fine.
It was nice.
It was nice. She said, fine. And then just kept looking at me like, next question. And I just remember like shitting a brick, being like, so do you like stuff? Like I wanted to ask anything else just to like get off the subject.
A lot of paper shuffling.
Yes.
Oh my God. Yeah, there's nothing worse than when you're asking a series of questions and you get a yes or no answer, and especially when you can sense there's like, do not, you know, touch upon this again.
Oh my God! Yeah, I was like, oh, how about that Manhattan traffic? Huh? It's crazy. Anyway,
how about them Bears?
Yeah. Exactly.
She was totally professional. She, you know, moved on like it was nothing. It was never really brought up again.
Right.
So.
Right.
Sure. What did y'all make of the new Pet Cemetery?
Bye.
Yeah.
Next question.
No, I mean, I thought it was interesting. I'm glad I saw it, but it was just that once with you, John, and that was enough for me.
I thought it was beautifully shot. It looked gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
I mean, Justin and I mean, I won't speak for you, Justin, but I feel too close to the original. Not just the film, but the place. I mean, if you're from New England, it doesn't take long to be like, that's not New England.
Right.
And there were, you know, some Zelda jump scares. I don't know. I thought it was adequate. I don't think it's going to be sort of revered decades from now, the way that the original seems to be.
No, I don't think so.
Cut to 15 years from now and you're making a documentary about it and going, well, I was wrong.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You have me back on and you play that clip and I'm like, well, shit.
Yeah, I think that movie would have had more juice if it hadn't revealed like the alteration they made to the story in the trailer. Like, right. I think discovering that on opening night and being like, oh, what is it doing now, would lead to a sense of like, I don't know what's about to happen here. This is a different thing. And that would have been really, again, cool to discover in the theater. But right. they blew that load like right off the bat, like yeah. on the first trailer, I think.
Well, yeah, I think it's twofold, and I need to revisit the movie because I do appreciate how bleak it is, and it doesn't shy away from that, which is the yes. first thing that I would assume would be on the chopping block for a modern remake, right? Is the kind of the bleakness and the inevitability of tragedy. But yeah, I think it's twofold. One, they spoiled the twist, which I think would have been a great word of mouth thing to propel people to get them interested in watching the movie. And then two, they didn't really follow up with the concept as well as I think they could have. Mm-hmm. You know, the concept of Ellie, the more grown child being the one that's back and different, and like, how is she different? How can she talk about the other side? And, you know, and the, you know, I don't know, it feels like that was the great idea that then just kind of sat there for a little bit, and then they're like, and then here's how the novel ends anyway, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I mean, Eric, I agree. Like, the look of it, I mean, it was bleak. It almost like, again, I've only seen it once, but there, you know, it almost like the way that you see a lot of like British films have almost like this blue kind of gloomy filter over the whole thing. I mean, it felt it felt dreary. It captured the it captured that, I thought, really well from like a visual perspective.
And again, I need to rewatch it.
I like the ending too.
Yeah, the ending's like, good.
You know, talk about bleak, but
yeah,
I need to revisit that one too. I think I only saw it the once.
Yeah, I think
Joe Lithgow did a great job too. I mean, obviously nobody can touch Fred Gwynne, but I felt for that type of character, I think Judd Lithgow really captured it.
Yeah. No, he's a great actor, and I think that since they've already took the main out of it, you know, I guess it wouldn't have made all that much sense to give him that thick accent. But, you know, I love Fred Gwynne in the original movie, and as cartoony as he is, like, it's the same thing. Like, again, we keep like comparing the two things, but they're both, I guess, New England movies. But it's like Jaws, hearing the real Martha's Vineyard, you know, locals that working in the shop, you know, with their New England drawls and all that, like that just really sets you in a place that just makes it slightly more authentic than your typical movie. So, yeah, I did miss the mannerisms really in the remake. And I know the realities of making movies, and that you can't just always shoot exactly where you want to shoot. You know, you have to go where the tax incentives are, because that's the only way that you'll make your budget and all that stuff. But yeah, I do miss the Fred Gwynne going all out with his ridiculous accent. There's something very comforting about his voice to me. It's that deep gravelly voice on top of the ridiculous accent.
Yeah.
Wasn't too far off, and we ran into a lot of people up there that sounded very similar to him. Maybe not as dramatic, of course, but definitely ran into a few people at the gas station that, you know, you turn your head and you might think you're talking to Fred Gwynne there.
Oh, I was so we. I think Scott and I were both like a little let down when we did our Banger and Bangor KingCast event up there, because I think we talked to like maybe two people in our entire time in Bangor that had even a hint of an accent.
Yeah.
The first time that I went out there though, I drove from Boston, and you know, when you drive from Boston, you take like about 75,000 fucking toll stops in there in between.
Yes, you do.
In between the two. And when I knew the second I crossed the main state line and you get to the next toll, the guy that was working the toll booth was like, might as well said a yeah, you know, at the end of what he was saying. And I'm like, fuck yes, I'm here. And then I never heard another accent for the rest of my time up there.
Oh man, you got to get him on the podcast.
I know, we need a real good Mainer. let's find us a good Mainer.
Yeah, I mean, just to touch on something that Justin said that I think it might be of interest to you guys, is sort of like, at least for me, with all the docs that I've done subsequently, and we have one in post-production right now that is another real regional story. You know, talking to just like the everyday people in Maine, you know, like the people on the crew that like had day jobs, that like had these ambitions of like making a movie or being involved with a movie set, or like thinking that maybe the pet was going to launch their career in the industry. You know, as much as I love talking to like the talent, you know, Dale and everybody, they're great. The people, like sort of the everyday people, you know, the just working class folks that were like got swept up into this like movie, this like once in a lifetime opportunity for them. Like that's the stuff that like I get super turned on about. And I think it's also speaks to King, right? Because I mean, I think like those are the people that's like who he writes about, the people at the diner, the people at the gas station, you know, like that, the barbers, these are the people that like he writes about and that I think he relates to. And I think that's one of the reasons why he's so universally loved, is because like he can still sort of touch that. And so that's like one of the things I look back on the Pet Sematary documentary, and like, those are my favorite people, the lead greensman, Arlene Hirsch, like just all of these, like sort of just everyday salt of the earth, Maine people that got to do something extraordinary that, you know, they still love and talk about.
That gets
me jazzed as a doc filmmaker every time.
Oh, I bet. And to your point, those are also the ones that have the photo albums and hear my Hi-8 recordings and stuff, and you get all that great great behind the scenes footage.
Exactly.
You said you had another doc in post, a regional Maine thing. What's it about?
Yeah, it's not a Maine story. It's not King related, so I won't bore you with the details and get off topic for your podcast. But it's called Sasquatch.
No, but I'm curious.
Yeah, yeah. It's called Sasquatch, the Lost Bigfoot Film of Massachusetts. And it's basically about this Bigfoot horror film that was made in the early 70s in Lowell, Mass, that played the theaters regionally, played drive-in, the drive-in circuit, and then disappeared. It never had any kind of release. It never had any kind of distribution. And so we started this in October of 2022 to sort of tell the story of this lost Bigfoot movie, which is sort of considered to be kind of like one of the holy grails of lost Bigfoot cinema.
Did you find it?
No comment.
You're asking to spoil the documentary.
These are people, like I said, they were everyday people that got swept up in something extraordinary. That's the project that we have in post-production. The plan is to hopefully have it out by Halloween. It's kind of that for me has sort of become, since the pet doc, that has become my passion, is like these regional monster stories. Justin and I collaborated. He shot interviews for me, a short doc that we did right before COVID called Snapper, the man-eating turtle movie that never got made. Which is on Screenbox now. It's streaming. We did a VHS release of it. But it's about a movie that never got made. And so like this idea of like lost films or unmade films or forgotten films has really been like what's sort of driven my creative ambitions for like the last 4 or 5 years.
I get it. That shit is endlessly fascinating to me. Yeah. Like these things that almost happened and then never did. So I'm definitely looking forward to seeing, can you tell me the name again? The Sasquatch movie.
So the original film is called Sasquatch. So Sasquatch, but drop the TCH.
Sasquatch.
Sasquatch. So Sasqua.
Oh, I see.
Is the name of the film. And so our doc is called The Lost Bigfoot Film of Massachusetts.
Hell yeah!
I'm glad you clarified that, because I thought the audio maybe just dipped out a little bit, and I'm
No.
Good. It's good to know.
Yeah.
Great. And, I guess, and we're kind of nearing the end here. Do you want to plug your Pet Cemetery doc and maybe the book? I don't know what info you have on that release, but now's your time to plug away.
Justin, you want to plug? You want me to plug?
Plug away, my man.
So Unearthed and Untold, it's still available on Blu-ray and it's streaming. I think pretty much anywhere you're streaming films. We're working on a book companion to the doc that we're hoping will come out this year, but it might be a next year thing depending on printing, publishing stuff. But we're also working with Josh Schaefer of Lunch Meat VHS, good friend of ours, to put the doc on VHS later this year.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Which would be really fun. So we're in the process of designing that now. So I guess all that's left is to figure out how to get it on like Betamax and Laserdisc, and then we will have got all the all the formats covered.
Yeah. Then 8mm.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're gonna have it, put on film. 16mm would be great.
Yeah. Perfect.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us today. This was a really interesting conversation. I love talking about Pet Cemetery, but looking forward to the next doc, and we hope you'll come back at some point, maybe with a new Stephen King doc.
That'd be great.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thank you very, very much.
Appreciate having us. Of course.
Many thanks to John Campopiano and Justin White. That is the second to last Wampler episode that I have in the bank. As originally planned, I was going to run all of Wampler's remaining episodes back to back to back, but I believe I have a new episode that needs to go up next week. I haven't recorded it yet, and it always gets a little sticky when announcing stuff that hasn't actually been in the can yet. But I will go ahead and tell you folks that we had organized a interview with one of my favorite working directors before Scott passed, and I will be doing that interview solo tomorrow. It is with director Jeff Nichols. You know him from Take Shelter. He did the very Stephen King-ish Midnight Special fairly recently. He's got a new movie out called The Bike Riders with Austin Butler and Tom Hardy and a bunch of people. Michael Shannon's in that one too. Saw the movie. It's great. I'm really excited to talk to this guy. He seems like a big Stephen King nerd. He has picked Night Shift as his topic. Not one particular story in Night Shift, by the way, the entirety of Night Shift. So I will be looking at Night Shift with Jeff Nichols for next week. So stay tuned for that. And then after that, the plan is to run the final KingCast episode with Scott Wampler. Bittersweet, to say the least, but we still got one more to go. And as for the Patreon, this Friday I will be hosting a mailbag to answer all the burning questions from the listeners. Usually these are only open to the Patreon members to ask these questions, but I feel like, given the circumstances, it's probably a good idea to open this up to just about anybody who wants to throw a question about Scott, about working on the show, about the future of the show, whatever you want to ask, you know, feel free to throw it my way, and that will all be answered in the mailbag for this Friday. And then if you want to send in a question, you can do it at thekingcast19@gmail.com. That's all one word, thekingcast19@gmail. And that will be what's going up on our Patreon this Friday. So if you want to sign up, and you damn well should, because we have nearly 4 years worth of extra episodes of the KingCast, one every week. You can do that at patreon.com/thekingcast and throw us a few bucks. $10 is our highest tier. That gets you everything, including access to our Discord, and the tier right below that will get you most everything. But you know, if you're going to go in there and sign up, why not go for the premium experience, baby? You get everything that way. So yeah, so I guess we'll see y'all next week for my chat with Jeff Nichols about Night Shift, and on the Patreon this Friday for a mailbag episode where I answer all of your burning questions. Adios, folks.
The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.